Hi everyone, and welcome to what is the last episode of this calendar year of the UKIS ITEL podcast. And what a podcast we have for you today. I am joined by two star guests, Sarah Hall.
Hi Anand, good to be here.
And Jill Rutter.
Happy Christmas, Anand.
And to you. And we're going to carry out a review of the year, and what a year it's been. It's been the year that President Zelensky came and addressed Parliament in Westminster, the year Nicola Sturgeon stood down, the year Gary Lineker became spokesperson for 50% of the population. We had a coronation for a new king. Boris Johnson ceased to be an MP. It was another year when we decided not to have a border in place with the European Union. And it was a fantastic year when England got absolutely thrashed every single game they played just about at the World Cup of Cricket. And it was the year I got married. But apart from that, nothing much happened. So, both of you, just your starter for 10. What are your highlights of 2023?
Well, Anand, I think you've opened the door there by your mention of England's World Cup performance, because I was going to mention a real highlight for many of us sports fans was watching the smug India being taken down by Australia in the World Cup final. But I will move on from that. There are other things. I think going back to, in terms of the most jaw-dropping thing, I think what's happened to the SNP is really, really interesting. Yep. Sort of, you know, if you hadn't expected that to happen. It just, you start the year, Nicola Sturgeon's been talking about, you know, possibility of a referendum, using the general election for that. She looks as though she's absolutely riding high. And then I just accepted an event I think you'd passed on to me to go to see Nicola Sturgeon at the LSE. And then the next day you suddenly get the news it's cancelled. She's giving a press conference and she's gone. Yep. In a sort of puff of smoke. And I think in terms of biggest change of fortunes, I think that was that. I mean, on the sort of Brexit front, the thing that you'd have to single out is the rapprochement between the UK and the EU, with that sort of, you know, rather lovey-dovey press conference between Rishi Sunak and Ursula von der Leyen in, I think appropriately, the place where King Charles and the Queen got married in Windsor, which perhaps was, you know, another sort of slightly surprising development, but less surprising, I think, than Nicola Sturgeon standing down and what then has happened to the SNP.
Cool. Okay, we'll come back to loads of that. Sarah, what will be the highlights for you?
Well, Anand, I also have to push at the open door of sport that you raised and say a big highlight for me as a Newcastle United fan was the Leeds relegation. So Jesus. big celebrations about that. In terms of sort of development.
You know, the cameraman's from Yorkshire, I'm just saying. You've upset him.
Straight talking, all the very best. I think the main thing that stands out for me is the kind of really stark change in sort of the broader economic landscape, and particularly, you know, what's happening about interest rates, the fact that they've stayed high and economies around the world are having to adapt to that. At the same time as we seem to be starting to see quite significant shifts in the sort of geopolitics around globalisation and where the UK sits with that, particularly arguments about whether we're seeing a kind of retreat back to more kind of national scale focused policies and economic growth. So for me, a rather curious mix of football and the economy.
What could be better? So let's start with the politics, Jill, where you started off. I mean, well, we might as well start with Scotland, I suppose. Nicola Sturgeon going was a fascinating story in its own right, but presumably it's part of the story of Labour's renaissance as well, because it opens up Scotland to Labour in a way that hadn't been the case for many people beforehand, and that changes things, doesn't it?
Yes, we sort of assumed that Labour was going to be still battling with the pandas for representation, though the pandas are about to board a plane back to China, I'm told. So Labour might have been able to achieve that even with one MP. But clearly one of the things that's really happened in terms of electoral geography has been Labour's failure to be able to bank on getting not just a big, you know, big tranche of seats in Scotland. It used to regularly get sort of, you know, 40 odd seats in Scotland, but its failure to get any seats in Scotland, that obviously made the electoral hill to climb much, much worse. So I think it's really interesting. I think one of the things that, you know, as an observer down here in London, I hadn't really expected was just quite how divisive the SNP leadership election would be. And we'd been through divisive Conservative leadership elections last year. I think that's given us a sort of foretaste that leadership elections could see very serious bloodletting. Yeah. But that ending up with this marginal victory for Hamza Yousef against somebody who seemed to be very outside what we'd seen beyond independence as the SNP mainstream in the shape of Kate Forbes, I thought was really, really interesting. But as you say, we've now got Labour becoming competitive again in Scotland. You know, we've got the Rutherglen by-election where they pulled off that victory. You know, maybe not the sort of, you know, most difficult seat for Labour to win back in Scotland, but a sort of shape, sign of things to come. Anna Sawa looking competitive for Holyrood, but also Keir Starmer repeatedly showing up in Scotland. See that we've also seen some implications of that for policy in terms of, you know, slightly dialing down some of the rhetoric about oil and gas because, yeah, you know, want to keep people on board and keep the GMB on board. So I think that's really interesting. And of course, we still don't quite know where the story ends for the SNP because, you know, the police have been doing their investigations,
yeah,
but this is sort of longer running than a series or 3 or 59 of Murder, She Wrote or Midsummer Murders. We still don't know whether anyone is going to be charged as an outcome of the police investigation into the SNP.
Yeah, I mean, I think however you spin it, one of the winners of 2023 is Keir Starmer, isn't he? I mean, he's had a good year, despite, you know, people continually voicing doubts. He's ending the year well ahead in the polls. He is making ground in Scotland. He's also making up ground in Wales, actually, after the Tories did very, very well in 2019.
And if we cast back to when, you know, Labour lost the Hartlepool by-election, when people were all thinking back then, you know, when is he going to be challenged? Is he in control? He now looks like a man who's very much in control of his party. You know, maybe wobbling slightly over the difficulties around around Israel-Gaza, but still very much in control of his party. You know, you can see that he sort of, you know, looks increasingly acting as though he's a prime minister in waiting. Obviously, not measuring the curtains, still with that Ming vase, but you know, basically one of the stories of the year, I think, is the absolute stasis in the opinion polls in terms of that Labour lead.
Yeah, and I suppose the other side of that coin is the state of the Conservative Party. I mean, I remember a couple of weeks ago when we had the Hampton Court Investment Summit, the sight of Rishi Sunak on that stage saying, we're open to immigrants, we're welcoming immigrants, whilst just down the road in Westminster, his party was tearing itself to bits about how best to stop immigrants coming here, almost summed up the state of the Conservative Party at the moment, because one of their problems seems to be they just can't agree with themselves.
Well, I thought that was one of the things that was really interesting at the Conservative Party conference that we were at, that actually it really looked, the energy was all on the fringe with different Conservative factions fighting for the future soul of the Conservative Party rather than, you know, being about the meeting of a governing party thinking about where did it next go with, you know, viable policy propositions. There seems to be a huge big ideological battle, and basically we saw that, I think, in Suella Braverman's resignation letter as well, that we are firing battle shots, you know, Kemi Badenoch's reaction to that. And it's all about what comes next, you know, once they've got over the year to come and, you know, a sort of what they seem to be penciling in, maybe not in number 10 Downing Street, but an awful lot of the party seems to be penciling in quite a big defeat. We've also seen a sort of rush for the exit gates of Conservative MPs who want to get ahead of their colleagues in the job centre queue.
I think as well, you see that kind of damage limitation in terms of what comes next when you think back to the autumn statement, and particularly some of the press stories around that, where there were stories being floated around, you know, the abolishment of inheritance tax, you know, policies that would really be looking to be attractive to kind of call London and South East Conservative voters. And that, to me, seemed to be a move to try and sort of prevent complete kind of apocalypse at the next election, and rather to kind of shore up a core vote to build on that in terms of what might come next.
Absolutely. And one of the really curious things about the Conservative Party for me at the moment is there is a genuine debate about who their core vote is, because for some people, the core vote are the new seats they won in 2019. And things like the rowing back on green commitments was meant to be targeted to them, though I'm not sure that's going to be necessarily very effective. And for others, of course, the core vote are the traditional Shire Tories. And that argument will continue to rage. But having a divided governing party isn't exactly helpful when it comes to having consistent economic policies, is it?
No, I mean, for me, one of the kind of ongoing stories in the past couple of years has been, you know, really persistent difficulties in stimulating growth for the UK economy. And you're absolutely right. One of the key things we know is that, you know, consistency, clear policy signalling, both in terms of kind of strategy, but also in terms of things like regulatory direction, are really central to attract some of the things that the UK really needs, particularly around investment and hopes that that would drive up productivity. I think within that, though, Jill and I were just chatting this morning, I think one of the shifts that we've seen in 2023, particularly in the Sunak administration, is a bit more of a rapprochement with business. So if you go back to kind of Theresa May's industrial strategy, for me, it was really noticeable that it didn't mention, you know, sectors that the UK is really strong in, like financial services. Then more recently, there's been a sort of background debate about, you know, to stimulate growth, should the UK perhaps try and be a bit more like Germany, look at kind of advanced manufacturing, or should we kind of double down on our strengths in financial services? I think what you've seen particularly, you know, as part of a wider rapprochement with the EU is Sunak definitely trying to make signals that he's trying to make the country attractive to business. And this reflects what we know about Sunak as a person and the kind of really significant impact that his time in California has had in terms of the types of businesses that he wants to attract, particularly, you know, tech firms, AI firms, those kinds of things.
I mean, there does really seem to be, Jill, a tension between the politics and the economics. That's to say, you know, it's obviously true that Sunak wants to attract all this investment, that he wants to sell Britain as a great place to sort of bring your company or bring your foreign direct investment. But the politics makes it so unpredictable, don't you think?
Well, I think you get that particularly acutely in the last year before an election.
Yeah.
When, you know, obviously it's quite bold to say that our slogan for the last year is long-term decisions for a better future, when really it's short-term decisions to make sure we have any future, because that's actually where you have to concentrate your firepower the run-up to that. Because, and we are in sort of survival strategies. I mean, I think some of the things that were being floated were very much targeted as, you know, can we get these people over into our camp or whatever. And the interesting thing at the moment within the Conservative Party, there's sort of two levels of survival, one of which is to get your MPs sufficiently supportive. And then the second one is to appeal to voters. I think it was, actually relatively laudable within that they did spend so much money of their fiscal headroom, in inverted commas, in the autumn statement on the full expensing move, which was not a retail-friendly voter move. I mean, you might have expected that to go into an additional 1p of national insurance or something. Could have done away with inheritance tax for that. Don't tell the backbenchers. But I think it's quite interesting. They were doing bits. So I think we've lost all that sort of active hostility to business that characterised the Brexit years, and in particular summed up Boris Johnson's approach to business, where they were telling him things he didn't want to hear and he didn't, you know, shut his ears and told them they knew where to go. So I think we have seen a bit of that. But I think it's incredibly difficult to ask a party really to take long-term decisions. But part of the problem is that Rishi Sunak saying on net zero has been destabilising frameworks that we thought were agreed, and we will pay a price for that beyond the next election.
Yeah, and I suppose the other thing to say about the Conservative economic policy is it's a tough time. I mean, you were hinting at this before. I mean, there are global forces here. But just looking back at the year, Sarah, has it panned out as you would have expected back in January? I mean, for some economists, it's actually, I mean, inflation has proven to be a bit stickier than they thought, and things aren't quite as rosy as many had hoped it would be by the end of the year. Is that fair?
Yeah, and I think that is fair. You know, inflation is proving stickier. I must say, I think that inflation is likely to come down possibly slightly more than the Bank of England seems to be projecting. And I say that because I'm not sure that we are fully accounting for the squeeze that's gone on in household spending over the past year, and particularly the way in which interest rate policy works in the UK. It's different to somewhere like the US, where most people are on fixed rate mortgages.
Yeah.
In the UK, we're waiting for some of this interest rate change to come down the track. So I do have concerns about household spending. And I think here, you know, the politics and the economics aren't super well aligned. Like, one of the questions you could ask about 2023 is, where's levelling up gone? Or are we actually levelling down? So I think one of the big political decisions that took place in 2023, which again sort of points to some of Sunak's policy direction changes, is the cancelling of the HS2 line from Birmingham to Manchester around the time of the Conservative Party conference. So on the one hand, you have policy decisions that don't look like they're supporting levelling up. On the other hand, the government has done a lot to support devolution and metro mayors, perhaps more than's been accounted for. So there's some quite radical plans for kind of spending settlement, particularly for Birmingham and Manchester, which make a lot of sense in terms of giving those cities more control of their budgets and trying to address some of the specific aspects that those places need to grow.
Want to come on that at all, Jill? What you make of devolution, where it's going? I personally, just for the record, I'm very cynical that Keir Starmer is going to deliver on some of the pledges he's made about shifting power out of Westminster. But
I think it's very difficult in practice when you have been out of power for a long time to come in and say, my mission is to do myself out of most of the interesting aspects of a job. I always remember a conversation I had back in 2011 or something like that with Nick Bolts, who'd was one of the sort of inventors of the policy of police and crime commissions. He was talking about a colleague of his who was the policing minister. And I said, well, why do you need a policing minister now you've got police and crime? And he said, well, yeah, you want to do things, don't you? You know, if you're there and you sort of think, well, your policy was to have transfer that responsibility and accountability to these elected police and crime commissions. Maybe one of the consequences of that is you don't have a dedicated person whose full-time job is policing minister. But I think it's really, really difficult because, you know, government expands to fill the space available. So, and I think the really interesting thing is how far is Rachel Reeves prepared to let go of budgets, particularly when budgets are tight. Now, one of the benefits of letting go of budgets is Andy Burnham is always saying you get better value. We can do more for less if you give it to us as a block. The really interesting thing is, you know, is government, you know, going to see that as a way of making the sort of numbers add up? So you get your sort of freedoms to do things, but you get it with a much smaller envelope than central government would have given itself to undertake the similar tasks. And then there's the question, I think, always with the UK's very ad hoc approach to things like that, which is you can see devolution going further in Manchester and Birmingham, but what are the places with less capacity? And, you know, what about the places where the agenda doesn't really fit at all? Yeah, we haven't, I think, developed a model to make that work in much of sort of more rural England.
I mean, I think the politics of metro mayors is really fascinating as well. You could imagine a Labour government with Labour metro mayors actually being critical of what a central government is. I remember two or three years ago...
Well, we saw that, actually. I mean, Anand, if you want a prime example of the sort of tension that leads to is the, you know, outfall from the Uxbridge by-election.
Yeah.
You know, did Keir Starmer go and say, no, obviously a Labour mayor has the policies that he think is appropriate.
Yeah.
This is something that's a passionate cause of Sadiq Khan. And, you know, I might not agree with him, but it's his right. No, it's instinct. We're paying an electoral price for this nationally.
Yeah.
And the problem is you do sometimes pay an electoral price for it nationally. You know, we've got to rein it back. Now, actually, they haven't succeeded in doing that. But I think that exposed some
Absolutely.
Of those tensions that were going to emerge as we have, you know, if we have a Labour government with quite a lot of Labour mayors. We've had Andy Street being publicly quite critical of some of the decisions of the government, you know, and being on resignation watch.
Yep.
Was he going to go, not go over HS2? So I think it's a really, really interesting new dynamic. And I'm not sure our politics has quite grown up enough for our Westminster politicians to just say, yeah, it's a different level of government. They sit on slightly different agendas and we agree quite a lot of the time, but there are quite a lot of areas on which we disagree. And that's okay. It's that's okay that we haven't quite got to yet.
Yeah. I remember being totally taken aback when we did an event at Labour conference with Tracy Brabin a couple of years ago on how do Labour win power in the Red Wall. And her opening statement was, we are in power. I'm in power. Completely took me aback. I didn't know what to make of it. But the final thing on the economic policy is everyone right to be as downbeat about our prospects for growth as they seem to be? Is there an obvious way we can deliver any growth at all to this economy?
So I do think that the sort of downward talking around growth, and particularly a week or so ago, Andrew Bailey at the Bank of England was really talking down the UK economy.
Yeah.
I think that's a little bit overstated, and it's easy to forget that there are some strengths to the UK economy. For example, we have a highly skilled labour market. we're strong in some sectors which globally are expected to grow. So that would be kind of, you know, knowledge-rich services. And we should have capacity to deliver on some emerging areas which are important, notably green and digital. Mm-hmm. I think the key challenges as I see them are twofold. One is we're a more profoundly uneven economy than most other G7 economies. And particularly when you look at productivity of our second cities, that really lags. So places like Leeds, Nottingham, the places that I've spent most of my life, in fact, no correlation, you know, their productivity is notably lower than places like Lyon in France, for example. So I think, you know, getting to grips with that is the first kind of key challenge. And that's been like decades long in the making in the UK and never really been radically gripped. I think the second area is something that we touched on earlier, the need for clear policy stability and regulatory stability. And that's super important in terms of, you know, if you're a business thinking about making a capital investment that might take 5-10 years to realise, you need to know what's likely to happen in the future. And actually in a high interest rate environment or a higher interest rate environment, that certainty becomes even more important. So I think they're the two issues. So I do think there are prospects, but I think we need to have our eyes open in terms of what the challenges are.
Jill?
Well, the interesting thing is, you know, when people are looking around for what is the sort of, you know, magic lever you could pull to transform UK prospects, you would say, well, what's the magic lever we pulled back in 2016 to slightly worsen our economic prospects, which was, of course, Brexit. So that's where you sort of say to people, well, if only we could improve the trade and cooperation agreement, have a closer relationship, remove these barriers that are hampering British business, et cetera, et cetera, we might be able to do something. The problem is, you know, as you know, work that Joel Roland and Janneke Vakoviak have done, is actually the prospects for a really significant deepening across the board of that trade relationship, while you still rule out, as all our leading politicians do, membership of the single market and the customs union, is pretty small beer. And we've seen actually some quite interesting tussles, I think, with Brussels over what on earth to do about this looming deadline on rules of origin.
Yeah.
Which I think has been a really interesting issue. I sort of thought that there were, you know, real sort of shades of Theresa May when Michel Barnier gave an interview to the FT where he said the TCA is the TCA. And you're not even allowed to agree changes that the TCA allows you to agree. I mean, you sort of think this is a very restrictive reading. That was quite interesting, though, that the European Parliament, a couple of weeks back, when it was debating the progress report on implementation of the TCA, said it was looking to exploit the opportunities. So maybe, you know, once Europe comes through its elections next year, we might get a sort of, you know, mutual benefits from both sides, slightly lightening up the relationship. But I think it's sort of difficult to see. And we have seen, you know, estimates that really is sort of, you know, starting to bear down quite significantly on the UK's economic prospects. Does that mean, you know, can we find workarounds? We're finding some workarounds. Can we use the freedoms that we've got from Brexit in a few areas? But generally, you know, inconvenient though it is, the general message from businesses, you know, you've got to converge with one of the big blocks, and our dominant big block, because it's still our biggest trading partner, is the EU. And that's a really sort of rather unwelcome message, at least to the current government.
I think, I mean, there are three key things, I suppose, from the last year when it comes to Brexit. The first, and perhaps most important, was the Windsor framework, which at least allowed us to be nice to each other again and to engage with each other and to do things like Horizon. But there's still no executive in Northern Ireland, is there?
No, I mean, no, we're always being told that the executive in Northern Ireland is 2 weeks away.
Yeah.
So who knows, but it seems to have been away for an awful long time now. And the real problem is that going back into government in Northern Ireland looks an increasingly unattractive prospect. There is an absolutely horrendous in-tray of local problems to deal with. So we're talking about pressures on public services, problems there. They've got, you know, the waiting lists for the NHS in Northern Ireland are much worse than they are in England, and we think they're pretty bad.
Yeah.
Here, you've got this huge big issue in Northern Ireland at the moment about what's happened to Loch Ness. It's really horrendous sort of pollution, things like that. And Northern Ireland is being penalised, at least until we see how much money they get from the UK Treasury, if and when they agree to go back into power, is still being penalised for overspending during the caretaker government. So they've been told that any Barnett consequentials that they might get, so the formula when spending increases in the UK, what they would normally expect to get as a consequence of that, that's going as a payment against their overspend for money that they've effectively been lent by the Treasury. So it's a pretty grim prospect in Northern Ireland. So so I think, you know, if they do go back, there will have to be a sort of another big Westminster check written. And although the sums seem small in Westminster arithmetic, you have to remember to multiply by 30 to get to the equivalent for England. Yeah. And then they're talking quite big money when you just throw in another billion.
Yeah. I suppose the second big thing was the government rowing back on its more ambitious plans for the retained EU law bill. We seem to have said that we're certainly not going to sunset all those laws at the end of this year, which was the original plan. But do you think this marks a sea change, that actually the idea that Brexit was all about divergence and ploughing our own separate furrow, is that idea dead now?
I mean, certainly for some people, that idea isn't dead. I think what really struck me about the retained EU law bill was the fact that, you know, every business you spoke to was saying, you know, this is a cliff edge that we don't have to go to and is really going to hurt us, because it's just giving us profound uncertainty in terms of what we're meant to be doing. For example, what safety monitoring are we using? What you know, across sectors, there's a really clear voice from government, from business, that this was a bad idea. And so I think what was interesting to me was that, you know, what one of the changes that led to the sort of decision not to go through that sunsetting process was that the government listened to business and recognised at some level that this was, you know, a sort of potential economic harm that they didn't need to take. I think the picture on divergence is much more complicated. And what really interests me around that is that the sort of world that we've entered post-Brexit, in terms of kind of big trade blocks, you know, what the US is doing, what the EU is doing, is quite different to the world in which the Brexit referendum was taking place in. You know, at that point, you might almost say, looking back, that was almost kind of like a high point of globalization and the quite open trade flows. Post-COVID, post-tensions between the US and China, in the wake of the Ukraine conflict, the Israel-Gaza conflict, there's much more kind of focus on, you know, the EU as a trade bloc, the US as a trade bloc. They've both announced really significant investment packages around green investment. And I think that does make a question that was always going to be there. You know, how is a post-Brexit UK going to interface with the EU, closest trading partner, and the US? That was always going to be a question. But I think the world in which we're now asking that question makes it much harder and more significant to answer. And I think for me, that's the sort of interesting part of the kind of divergence jigsaw that isn't totally clear at the moment. We get mixed messages depending on what kind of area you're looking at.
And crucially, it's an EU that prioritises the development of domestic industry over the benefits of trade. I mean, that's the crucial thing that seems to have shifted. But Jill, I mean, one of the things that Joelle talks about a lot in the divergence tracker, and which I think is going to lead to some very, very interesting conversations in the year ahead, is this notion of passive divergence, that even if our government has decided not to scrap all those EU laws and to diverge, the EU keeps doing stuff, and we need to figure out what to do with things like the carbon border adjustment mechanism. Is there any sign that Westminster and Whitehall have got a handle on this?
Well, I think one of the things I was going to say is that don't underestimate just how much make work the retained EU law bill meant for people who could have been getting on thinking about you know, more strategically, where do we want to go on regulation? Because, you know, reviewing that massive back catalogue, if only to identify 600 pieces of vaguely redundant law to take off the statute, but was really, you know, not quite what a pressured civil service really needed. And I think it did get in the way of better reform, and sort of reforms that, you know, the Treasury put through in the Financial Services Markets Act, where they actually took it away and then thought, what do we want to do instead, rather than just do a sort of blunderbuss sunset approach. But I think it's really interesting, because there'll probably be a sort of hiatus in EU legislation as we get to the end of this commission and we get to the elections. So we'll have a bit of time to take stock. But then it becomes really interesting for a government that has a sort of, you know, maybe does want to do some alignment. At the moment, we're sort of aligning on sort of outcomes, but trying to get there in a different way. The EU adopts it sort of deeply, and maybe this is because you have to do this, you're doing it for 27, very prescriptive processes, and then tends to, you know, assume the outcomes follow. The UK has, I think, what Joel calls a more sort of effects-based approach, where we look at actually what happens, but obviously then you slightly have to keep in mind, does it produce a similar effect at the end of the day when you have rather under pressure regulators trying to make these things work, lighter touch and stuff like that. But I think it's really, really interesting what would happen if you did have a government that wanted to keep more pace with EU legislation, you know, just to ease trading burdens, because what they don't have anymore is any equivalent to the European Communities Act to just do this through secondary legislation. So it'd have to take loads and loads of primary legislation. And one of the things that's emerging is one of the problems for the UK is, you know, it's much easier for us to be nimble and tweak laws. But if we want to change things, we now have to do it through primary legislation, which is then a clunkier way of doing things. So I think it's really interesting. Would any government dare take a power, as the Scots tried to do with the Continuity Act, take a power to allow it to align with EU law in which we've had no say through secondary legislation? I think that would be a very courageous minister. But otherwise, passive divergence is going to get bigger and bigger.
Yeah, and just the practicalities of keeping track of EU law is proving quite difficult, I think, at the moment.
Yes, I think it's really interesting to ask whether the UK not only has track of things that are being, that are sort of, if you like, under discussion and on the table, we now don't get circulated the papers as of right, we have to go and find that out, but are we really doing what the countries that are really successful third countries enacting with the EU? Are we in there to know what's coming up so we can influence the coming agenda? Now, the UK was always criticised when we were a member state of being quite good at negotiating when things were tabled, but not very good at influencing the upcoming agenda, maybe with the exception around the single market. But I think it's a really sort of interesting question of, are we sort of getting stuck in? Are ministers devoting political time and effort to that? You know, do we have good enough intelligence networks out there in Brussels? Are we plugged in enough? Are our businesses plugged in enough to what's going on? And are we willing to put in the hard yards and think, actually, you know, we need to be influencing now because this could affect us either, you know, directly for UK business competitiveness, or, and we haven't seen this yet, all through the way it will, you know, work in the Windsor framework, if it's something that's going to do there. And where, you know, the risk of a substantial trade impact could lead to MLAs in Northern Ireland, if they ever get back to the Assembly, triggering the Stormont break, which we haven't seen operate at all yet.
I think as well, those questions are heightened where in some areas, there's questions about, you know, who's setting the global standards, and the EU clearly wants to set global standards in things like green finance, for example. So knowing what's coming down the tracks in terms of not only what the EU might be doing within the EU, but also what might be shaping international standards that historically the UK has been really strong at leading is another key reason why kind of knowing what's coming is going to be important.
So there's plenty of stuff for us to watch in the year ahead. I want to finish with a prediction from both of you about a specific issue. We have delayed again this year the introduction of our border operating model on the UK-EU border. Do you think that will be put in place early next year, as the government has said?
Well, if you were, I mean, Rishi Sunak's got a bit of a margin because, you know, his inflation target for the end of the year is going to be met. And I think that might have been one of the motivations behind delaying the October controls, because they were, did seem to be worried about cost for business. But any business you would talk to, well, businesses always say it's always a bad time to impose border controls.
Yep.
It's bad in October because it's the run up to Christmas. It's bad in January because, remember, these are predominantly controls on sort of agri-food, because that's those are the sort of dark months when we're most dependent on imports. So I think the thing that the government is really worried about is both prices, and food price inflation has come down a bit, but it's still pretty high by any measure. But they're also worried about shortages. And the real worry is that if you say to an EU business that actually has got quite a lot of demand within the EU, where you've got a whole bunch more hassle now importing into the UK, then they say, well, actually, maybe I'll now take my goods to the Netherlands or Germany or somewhere like that. So you're a Spanish truck driver. So I think it's, I don't know, we have to see, but I think that, are we going to see it this side of the election? No, we've got the world's best border coming in 2025, allegedly. Let's do it all then.
So you lean towards no?
I also lean towards no, which I know is very boring on a podcast, but I just cannot see why they would use up political capital at the start of next year to kind of go through that with the risks that, that Jill has mentioned. I mean, I think particularly on food price inflation, you know, it's a sort of important message that, you know, prices are not coming down on the in, on the shelves. They're not going up as quickly, but they're not coming down, and voters will recognise that.
And then think, if you get a sort of Labour government coming in,
Downing Street, Sakir.
One of the things they're quite keen to do is to do a deal on SPS, on sanitary and phytosanitary standards, which remove the needs for quite a lot of those controls. Now, you could say, well, if you think you've got to force the EU to the table, it's much better, puts you in a much better negotiating position if EU people moving goods into the UK face the same barriers as our people do moving them in. So it gives you a bit of leverage, which we've tossed away at the moment. But equally, you know, do for 1 year only. Maybe you take a bet that actually I never really need to conform to these controls. So maybe I'll take a bet on not bothering to supply the UK for a bit and coming back in a year's time when it's a better place to go into.
So watch this space about us taking back control of our borders, in other words. But I tend to think that this will be a nice bequest to Keir Starmer that the Conservatives could leave him if they put their minds to it. Right, I'm afraid we've run out of time. It was always a bit bold trying to do the review of a whole year in such a short space of time. But thank you, Sarah.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jill. Do, as ever, check out our website for the latest commentaries on the blog section, for a whole load of reports, because we've been hyperactive this year. We look forward to seeing you, or you should look forward to hearing us again in the new year. Happy Christmas, everyone. Take care. Bye.